Now, everyone is seated cross-legged, motionless, the lamas and officials on their thrones whose heights vary according to their rank, and the common ecclesiastic folk on long benches nearly on the level of the floor. Chanting begins, deep-toned in a slow rhythm. Bells, wailing gilings. A musical instrument like a hoboy, thundering ragdong. A kind of huge theban trumpet. Tiny drums and big drums on which the cadence is beaten, at times accompany the samadhi. The little novices, seated at the extremity of the benches near the door, hardly dare to breathe. They know the hundred-eyed CHO Stimpa 66. An official who enforces discipline in the Gompa, especially during the religious ceremonies. 66 soon detects any chatting or playful gestures, and fear-inspiring are the rod and whip that I hung at hand, next his high seat. Chastisement, however, is not for little boys only, and full-grown members of the religious order may well receive at times their good share of it. I have witnessed queer performances of that kind. One of them took place in a monastery of the Sakya sect during a solemn festival. Several hundred monks were assembled in the Tsokan assembly hall, and the usual liturgy and music was going on, when three men communicated something to each other by gesture. As they were not seated on the front bench, they thought themselves sufficiently screened by the monks placed in front of them. The slight motion of their hands and the looks they exchanged would, they believed, not be noticed by the Chostimpa. But most likely, the patron gods of the lamasaries invest these stern officials with a supernormal keenness of sight. The Chostimpa had seen the culprits and started towards them. He was a tall, dark kampa, a native of Kham, in eastern Tibet. 68 with athletic features, and standing on his high seat, as on a pedestal, looked like a bronze statue. Majestically, he took down his whip, descended from his throne and strode across the hall with the air of a destroying angel. He passed before me, tucking his toga above his elbows. The whip which he clutched in his large hand was made of several leather ropes, each the size of a forefinger and ended by a knot. Having reached the place where the culprits awaited their unavoidable chastisement, he grasped their necks from behind, one after the other, lifting them brutally from the bench. It being impossible even to think of escape, the resigned fellows moved to the passage between the rows of monks and the prostrated themselves, their forehead against the floor. A few strokes of the whip sounded on the back of each one, and the fearful personage, with the same supreme dignity of demeanor, returned to his seat. However, only minor offenses, as breach of silence, incorrect attitude, etc., are punished in the assembly hall. More severe penalties are carried out elsewhere. A much appreciated intermission cuts the long service. Tea is brought in steaming hot, flavored with butter and salt, according to the Tibetan taste. It is carried in large wooden buckets whose bearer walk along the rows. Each tripper produces his own bowl, kept till then under his vest next his skin. The bowls are of special patterns which vary according to the sects. No china or silver ornamented bowls are allowed at the assembly. The highest dignitaries must use a plain wooden one. Yet even that rule, meant as a symbolic remembrance of the renunciation and poverty enjoined by the original Buddhist discipline, is avoided by the astute lamas. The bowl of the richest among them is truly in wood, but some of these wooden utensils, made of special timbers out of the excrescences that grow on the trunk of certain trees, are highly prized and may cost as much as the equivalent of £6 in local currency. In wealthy gompas, the tea is generously buttered, and the monks bring with them, to the assembly, a small pot in which they blow a certain quantity of the butter that rises to the surface of the liquid. This they use at home or sell to be put again into or to fill the lamps used in the house. Not the altar lamps, for which new butter is required. Tirupas bring also some Tsampa 69. Flour made with roasted barley, which is the staple food of all Tibetans. 69 from their own houses, and this flour, together with a tea provided free, constitutes their breakfast. Upon certain days, Tsampa and a piece of butter are distributed with the tea, or a soup served instead of tea, or even the meal includes both tea and soup. The inmates of the famous lamaseries enjoy a rather large number of these special breakfasts offered by rich pilgrims or by wealthy grand lamas belonging to the monastery itself. On such occasions, hills of tsampa and huge heaps of pieces of butter, sewn in sheep's stomachs, fill the Gompa's kitchen to overflowing. The spectacle is still greater when it is a question of soup, for then a number of sheep's carcasses amounting sometimes to several hundred are cut up for the gargantuan broth. While living in Kumbum and in other monasteries, though, as a woman, I was not allowed to take part at the monastic banquet, a pot full of the special dainty of the day was brought to my house whenever I wished. It was in that way that I became acquainted with a certain Mongolian dish made of mutton, rice, Chinese dates, butter, cheese, curds, sugar candy, and various other ingredients and spices, all boiled together. This was not the only sample of their culinary science with which the Lamaist chefs treated me. A distribution of money takes place, sometimes, during the meal. Mongolians greatly outdo Tibetans in their liberality to the clergy. I have seen some of them leave more than 10,000 Chinese dollars at the Kumbum monastery during their visit. So, day after day, in the frosty morning or the warm summer dawns, that peculiar Lamaist matins is performed in countless gompas all over the immense territories. The whole of Mongolia, parts of Siberia, of Manchuria and even of European Russia, of which Tibet itself is but a small part. Each morning, half-awake lads, together with their elders, are bathed in that curious atmosphere which is a blend of mysticism, gastronomic preoccupations and anticipations of a dole. That beginning of the day in the Gompa gives us an idea of the character of the whole Lamaist monastic life. In the latter we find also, always present, the same ill-assorted elements, subtle philosophy, commercialism, lofty spirituality and eager pursuit of coarse enjoyments. And these are so closely interwoven that one endeavors in vain to completely disentangle them. Youngsters brought up amongst these conflicting streams of influence yield to one or other of the according to their natural propensities and the way in which they are directed by their masters. Out of that early, rather incoherent monastic training, issue a small elite of literati, a number of idle, dull, sleepy fellows, wanton braggarts, and a few mystics who resort to lonely hermitages and lifelong meditations. The majority of the Tibetan trippers and lamas do not, however, belong exclusively to any of these different classes. They rather harbor in their mind, at least in potentiality, all of these various characteristics, and, according to the circumstances, one or another appear on the stage to play its part. Plurality of personalities in the apparently single individual is, of course, not peculiar to Tibetan lamas, but it exists in them in a remarkably high degree, and on that account their discourses and behavior provide the attentive observer with continual matter for wonder. Tibetan Buddhism differs widely from Buddhism as seen in Ceylon, Burma and even China or Japan. So, also, Lamaist monastic dwellings have their own quite peculiar aspect. As I have already mentioned, in Tibetan language, a monastery is called a gompa. Spelling in pa. That is to say a house in the solitude, and this name is entirely justified. Proudly isolated on summits beaten by the wind amidst wild landscapes, Tibetan gompas look vaguely aggressive, as if bidding defiance to invisible foes, at the four corners of the horizon. Or, when squatting between high mountain ranges, they often assume a disquieting air of laboratories where occult forces are manipulated. That twofold appearance corresponds to a certain reality. Though nowadays the thoughts of the monks may be mostly occupied by mercantile and other vulgar cares, Tibetan gompas were not, originally, intended for such earthly-minded folk. The hard conquest of a world other than that perceived through the senses, transcendental knowledge, mystic realizations, mastery over occult forces, such were the aims for the pursuit of which were built the Lamaist towering citadels and those enigmatic cities concealed in the maze of snowy hills. Yet nowadays mystics and magicians must be looked for mostly out of the monasteries. in order to escape an atmosphere that has become too much permeated by material cares and pursuits, they emigrate to more remote, inaccessible places, and the discovery of hermitages entails, sometimes, all the hardships of a real exploration. Nevertheless, with a very few exceptions, anchorites begin life as novices in the regular religious order. The boys whom their parents destine for a clerical life are taken to the monastery at the age of 8 or 9. They are given as wards to a monk of their own family parentage, or, failing a relative in the monastery, to some intimate friend. As a rule, the tutor of the novice is his first teacher and, in many cases, his only one. However, wealthy parents, who can afford generous recognition to the tuition of an erudite monk, either entrust the guardianship of their sons to such a one, or make an arrangement to the effect that the lads be sent to him to be taught at appointed hours. Sometimes, also, they beg for their sons the favor of being admitted as boarders in the house of an ecclesiastic dignitary. In that case, the latter will more or less supervise the youth's education. These novices are supported by their parents, who send to their tutor's house the usual supply of butter, tea, sampa and meat. Besides substantial provisions, rich Tibetans send to their sons various dainties: cheese, dried fruits, sugar, molasses, cakes, etc. Such treasures play a great part in the everyday life of the boys lucky enough to possess them. They allow of countless bartering, and many services can be bought from poor and common fellow students with a handful of shrunk, stone-like apricots, or a few bits of desiccated mutton. Young Tibetans begin, in that way, the apprenticeship in the tricks of trade while they are spelling out the first pages of religious treatises. One may guess that their progress in the former science is, often, more rapid than in the latter. Entirely destitute boys become jayog, servant of virtue or virtuous servant. That is to say that in exchange for menial work, they get teaching and sometimes also food and clothing at the house of a monk. Needless to add that, in this case, lessons are, as a rule, rare and brief. The professor, who is often illiterate or nearly so, can only teach the lads to memorize parts of the liturgic recitations, which they mangle dreadfully, and whose meaning they will never understand. Numbers of jayog remain without being taught anything at all. It is not that their work as servants is heavy, but the carelessness natural to their age prevents them from asking for lessons which are not imposed on them, and they spend their many leisure hours playing with other little fellows of their own condition. As soon as they are admitted to a monastery, the novices have a share in the income of the gompa and in the gifts made by the devotees to the community. If, when growing older, the novice feels inclined to study and if circumstances allow, he may seek admission to one of the monastic colleges. There are 4 of them in all, large lamaseries. As for the youths who belong to smaller gompas where no such colleges exist, they may at any time get leave to go and study elsewhere. The subjects taught are philosophy and metaphysics in the Tsunid College, ritual and magic in the Jayad College, medicine, according to Chinese and Indian methods, in the Men College, and the sacred scriptures in the Du College. Grammar, arithmetic and several other sciences are taught outside of these schools by private professors. Both junior and senior students of philosophy hold discussions at regular dates. Often the latter take place in the open, and in all large lamaseries a shady garden, surrounded by walls, is reserved for that purpose. Ritualistic gestures accompany the controversies and are a lively part of it. There are peculiar ways of turning one's rosary around one's arm, clapping one's hands and stamping when putting a question. There are other prescribed ways of jumping when giving an answer or replying to one interrogation by another. And so, though the words exchanged are usually but quotations, and only do honor to the memory of the controversialists, their antics and challenging attitudes create the illusion of passionate debates. Yet, all members of the philosophical college are not mere parrots. Amongst them one finds eminent literati and subtle thinkers. They too can quote for hours from countless books, but they are also able to descant on the import of the old texts and bring forward the results of their own reflections. A noteworthy feature of these public contests is that, at the end of them, he who has been acknowledged the victor is carried round the assembly riding on the shoulders of his defeated opponent. The College of Ritualistic Magic is generally the most sumptuously housed of the Gompa's scholastic institutions, and its fellows, called Gyanpa, are held in high esteem. They are believed to know the special technique which enables one to propitiate the fierce deities and subjugate evil spirits, and the protection of their monasteries is entrusted to them. The Gyanpa belonging to the two great Gyan colleges that exist at Lhasa, act in the same capacity on behalf of the state. Their appointed duty is to attract prosperity to Tibet and its ruler, as well as to shelter them from all bad influences and malignant undertakings. Gyanpa are also entrusted with the task of honoring and serving the aboriginal gods or demons, whose goodwill or neutrality had been previously won by promising them perpetual worship and attendance to their needs. They must, also by their magic art, keep the untamed evil spirits bound in captivity. Though for lack of another word in the English language we are compelled to refer to the Gompas as monasteries, they do not in the least resemble a Christian monastery. Excepting the fact that the inmates of the Gompa are celibates and that the monastery owns property, I hardly see a point in common between the Christian and the Lamaist religious orders. As to celibacy, it must be remembered that all monks of the Jlugspa 74. Jlugpa 74 sect, familiarly called Yellow Cap sect, are celibate. But in the various Red Cap sects celibacy is only enjoined on fully ordained monks called Jalongs. Married lamas or trappers keep, outside of the Gompa, a home where their family lives. They have also a dwelling place in their respective monasteries where they stay occasionally, at the time of religious festivals or when retiring for a period of religious exercises or meditation. Wives are never allowed to cohabit with their husbands in the enclosure of a monastery. Lamasaris are meant, just as the viharas of Ceylon or the monasteries of any Buddhist country, to house people who pursue a spiritual aim. That aim is neither strictly defined nor imposed and common to all Gompa's dwellers. Humble or lofty, as it may be, the goal of each monk remains his secret and he may endeavor to reach it by any means he chooses. No devotional exercises in common, nor uniform religious practices are enjoined on the inmates of the lamasaris. The only rules that exist are of a lay character, relating to the good order, the keeping up of the monastery, or the attendance of the members of the Gompa to daily or occasional meetings. These assemblies themselves have nothing to do with the celebration of a cult in which each one present joins for his own sake and from which he expects good fruits for himself. When Lamaist monks meet in the assembly hall, it is, beside hearing communications from the monastic authorities, to read parts of the scriptures for the benefit of the monastery, the state, or the supporters and occasional benefactors of the Gompa. Such readings are credited with happy results in bringing prosperity, averting illness and calamities, and keeping away malevolent beings. As for the ritualistic ceremonies, all of a magic nature, they are also performed for some aim in which the celebrants have no share. It is even believed that none can perform them for his own sake. The most proficient Gyanpa are compelled to call a colleague when they wish to have these rites celebrated on their behalf. Magic for personal purposes, meditation and exercises connected with spiritual life, are accomplished privately by each monk in his own dwelling. None but the teacher whom he has chosen has the least right to interfere in that matter. No one either has any right to ask any account of the Lama's views. He may believe whatever doctrine he deems true. He may even be an utter unbeliever, this concerns himself only. There is no church or chapel in the Lamaist monasteries, for, as it has been explained, no worship is done in which the laity joins or even merely attends. Beside the assembly hall there exist a number of lakhans, that is to say God's houses. Each of them is dedicated to a deity or to some Buddhist worthies, historical or mythical. Those who wish it pay courteous visits to the images of these exalted persons. They light a lamp or burn incense in their honor, salute them with three prostrations and depart. Favors are often begged during such visits, but not always, and a number of these polite meetings are the outcome of disinterested reverence. before the images of the Buddha boons are not requested, for Buddhas have passed beyond the world of desire and, in fact, beyond all worlds. But vows are taken and spiritual wishes expressed such as, may I be, in this life or in the next one, able to distribute a quantity of alms, to contribute efficaciously to the welfare of many, or may I be able to understand the meaning of Buddha's doctrine and to live accordingly. There are a larger number than one would suppose who, when raising a small lamp in the gesture of an offering before the Buddha's image, ask for no more than spiritual insight. Though they may make but little practical effort to reach it, the mystic ideal of salvation through enlightenment remains alive amongst Tibetans. To the complete spiritual freedom of the Lamaist monk corresponds a nearly equal material liberty. The members of a monastery do not live in community, but each one in his own house or apartment, and each one according to his own means. Poverty is not enjoined to them as it was to the early Buddhist monks. I must even say that the Lama who voluntarily would practice it would enjoy no special regard on that account, quite the opposite. Anchorites only may indulge in that kind of eccentricity. Yet, absolute renunciation, as India, and maybe India alone, has thoroughly understood it, is not an ideal altogether foreign to Tibetans. 75. The ascetic poet Mylarspa, 11th century, the most popular of Tibetan saints, is an instance, nor do they fail to pay homage to its loftiness. Stories of youths of good family who leave their home and take to the life of religious mendicants, and especially, the story of Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, who gave up his estate and princely rank. One may be ordained in any grade of the religious order without becoming a member of a monastery, though this seldom happens, and only when the candidate is of an age to know what he is doing and intends to live as an anchorite. Admission in a gompa does not confer any right to free lodging therein. Each monk must build his dwelling or purchase it from a previous owner, unless he inherits it from a relative or from his own teacher. Poor monks rent a room or two in the house of a more wealthy colleague. In the case of students and of learned or old tripa, lodging is often granted free to them in the houses of rich lamas. The poorest ones who, beside a shelter, need also board, engage themselves in the service of wealthy members of the monastery. Their condition depends on their ability. Some may be clerks, others cooks, or stable boys. Those who succeed in becoming stewards of a talku, often become important and wealthy persons. Learned monks belonging to poor families may earn their livelihood as teachers, as artists if they are gifted at painting religious pictures, as resident chaplains at the houses of rich lamas or laymen, or by occasionally performing religious ceremonies at householders' homes. Besides these various professions, divination, astrology, drawing horoscopes may be reckoned amongst their sources of income. The Lama doctors create very favorable situations for themselves if they show their skill by curing a sufficient number of distinguished people. But even with a small amount of success, the medical profession is a lucrative one. However, the profession which looks the most attractive to many is trade. The great majority of those Lamaist monks who are not especially religious-minded, become traders. If they lack the money needed to undertake a business of their own, they engage themselves as secretaries, accountants, or even as mere servants of a trader. Transacting business, in a more or less unostentatious way, is to a certain extent allowed in the monasteries. As for those of their members who have a really big business, they obtain leave from the authorities of the monastery to travel with their caravan, and open shops or branches wherever they like. One may think that trade does not fit in very well with religious pursuits, but we must also remember a monk has very seldom chosen his own profession. Most of them are led to the monastery as little boys, and it would be unjust to reproach them for not following a mystic avocation which has never been their own choice. Trading on a large scale is carried on by the lamasaries themselves as a means of increasing their income. They barter and sell the products of their land and cattle which they receive from their tenants. To these are added the revenue derived from the big collections called kartik. These collections take place at regular intervals, each year or every 2 or 3 years. The lamas resort, also, to occasional appeals when building a new monastery, or a new temple in an already established lamasery, and for various other purposes. Small monasteries merely send some of their monks in the neighboring regions to beg alms, but in large gompas, going to Kartik takes all the forms of an expedition. Groups of trippers may go from Tibet to Mongolia, spend months traveling across the country and return like triumphant warriors with hundreds of horses, cattle, gold, silver and goods of every description, all offerings from the devotees. They have a peculiar custom of entrusting, for a time a certain amount of money, or a quantity of goods, to an official of the monastery, who must traffic with that capital so as to provide for certain special expenses out of his profit. As an instance, he must supply during 1 year, or more, the butter needed to keep burning the lamps of a particular lakhang, or he must give a fixed number of meals to the whole community or, again, support the expenses of building repairs, horse fodder, reception of guests and many other things. At the end of the period, be it 1 year or three, the capital entrusted to him must be given back. If the man who has received it, as a deposit, has been able to make more profit than was needed to cover his expenses, so much the better for him. He can keep the balance. But if he has expended more than his profit, he must pay it from his own pocket. In any case, the capital must remain intact. The administration of a large monastery is as complicated as the administration of a town. Beside a population of several thousand men living between their walls, these gompas own large estates inhabited by tenants to whom they owe protection and over whom they have the right of justice. A number of elected officials, helped by clerks and a kind of police body, all clerics, assume the care of these temporal affairs. A big personage called Tsogs Chenchlungo is the elected head of the gompa. To him belongs the infliction of punishments on those who infringe monastic rules. It is he who grants leave, dispensations and admission to the gompa. He is assisted by several other officials. All of them wear ceremonial cloaks adorned with precious stones and carry massive silver sticks encrusted with golden ornaments and inlaid with turquoise and coral. The policemen, called Dob Dobs, are well worth special mention. They are recruited amongst the athletic unlettered braggarts whose fathers have placed them as children in the monastery when their place ought rather to be in the barracks. Brave with the wild rashness of brutes, always on the lookout for quarrels and mischief, these impudent scoundrels have all the picturesque characteristics of medieval ruffians. The badge which they favor is dirt. Grease, they think, increases the martial appearance of man. A true brave never washes himself, nay more, he blackens his face with the greasy soot that sticks on the bottom of the cauldrons, till he looks like a real negro. Sometimes poverty is responsible for the ragged garments worn by the dob-dob, but he often deliberately tears his monastic robe, to look, he thinks, more terrible. Nearly always when putting on a new dress, his first care is to make it greasy. Tradition commands it. However costly the material may be, the dob-dob kneading butter in his black hands, spreads it all over his new clothes. These strange fellows consider that nothing can be more elegant than a robe and a toga which has become as shining as velvet and stiff as armor, by the careful and constant application of dirt and filth. The miraculous tree of Tsongkhapa, the monastery of Kumbum, owes its celebrity to a miraculous tree. I borrow from the Kumbum Chronicles the following details about it. In 1555, the reformer Tsongkhapa, founder of the Jlugspa sects. Jelupka, Yellow Hats sect. Literally Jlugspa means those who have virtuous customs. Deprived of light and air, the tree could not but die. And as, according to the chronicles, the Khotan was built in the 16th century, the fathers Hukengaybet at best could only have seen the dried skeleton of the tree. But their description applies to a living one. 76 was born in a meadow, in northeastern Tibet, at the place where now stands the great lamasery of Kumbum. A short time after the child's birth, the Lama Dubjin Karmador prophesied that his career would be an extraordinary one and advised his parents to keep the spot where his mother had been delivered perfectly clean. A little later, a tree began to grow there. Even today, Beaten earth is used as the floor in most houses of Amdo, and the natives sleep on cushions or carpets spread on that floor. This makes it easy to understand the tradition according to which the tree grew out of the blood that had been spilled during the confinement and cutting of the umbilical cord. At first, the sapling did not bear any peculiar signs on its leaves, but owing to its miraculous origin, it enjoyed some fame and was worshipped by people of the neighborhood. A monk built a hut next to it and lived there.